Hello there. Welcome to the second episode of Turkey Book Talk in 2018. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and share both of them with friends to spread the word. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, and do make sure to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which may seem like a small thing, but it really does help increase awareness of the podcast for other potential listeners. If you enjoy or benefit from Turkey Book Talk, consider supporting it through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can check out details and links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. I should also say that I'm currently making plans for a new membership system going forward, which will involve various other perks for paying Turkey Book Talk members in addition to the audio podcast. Fingers crossed I'll be able to give you more information about this in the next episode in a couple of weeks, so do stay tuned for that. But now let's crack on with this latest episode. In it, we hear from Edhem Eldem. He's a professor of history at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul and is currently in France after being elected last year as a member of the Collège de France. He's the editor, along with Hüseyin Alul and Henk de Smiley, of a new volume of essays called To Kill a Sultan, a transnational history of the attempt on Abdul Hamid II, 1905, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan. The book brings together contributors to a conference at the University of Antwerp, looking at various aspects of an assassination attempt that targeted Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II back in 1905. On Friday, July the 21st of that year, the Sultan was the target of Operation Necuik, a bomb attack at Istanbul's Yıldız Palace, plotted by a group of mainly Armenian revolutionaries. Abdul Hamid emerged unscathed, but the casualties were enormous. 26 innocent bystanders killed and 58 seriously wounded. Today the attempt is almost entirely forgotten, but it had a huge effect at the time, prompting a grim crackdown within the Ottoman Empire and a diplomatic crisis with Europe due to the role in the plot of a young Belgian anarchist called Edward Joris. During his reign, Abdul Hamid II was notorious in Europe as the Red Sultan, caricatured as a barbaric Oriental despot responsible for the massacre of Armenians in the 1890s and generally descending into an autocratic and paranoid rule over more than three decades on the throne. But he's become the subject of a growing popular cult in today's Turkey among religious nationalists and conservative Islamists. These groups see Abdul Hamid II as the last proudly Islamic Ottoman leader standing up to the West and uniting the Muslim world. They believe his reign has instructive parallels with the rule of current President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Among the examples of this new cult of Abdul Hamid II is a new TV series, Payitaht, which appears on state broadcaster TRT and which focuses on the final years of his reign, portraying a pious sultan besieged and betrayed by Zionists, Freemasons, and European imperialists. In a recent speech, President Erdogan himself advised young people to watch Payitaht to, quote, understand our history. I asked Edhem Eldem about these contemporary developments later in the conversation, but I started by asking him to reflect on why the 1905 assassination attempt against Abdul Hamid II remains important today.
It's extremely important for several reasons. First of all, because it's one of the most spectacular bomb attacks, terrorist, anarchist attacks of the early 20th century. We know of many cases at the end of the 19th century of regicide, of attempts against kings, emperors, and against presidents of the republic, as in the case of Sadi Carnot. But these were always focused on one man trying to kill the crowned head or the sovereign or the head of state. Whereas here there is a very modern touch to it. I mean, this idea of bringing in a carriage with bombs, loaded with bombs, and to detonate it from a distance in order to create both chaos and ultimately the goal was to kill Abdul Hamid, but they failed. That's very modern. I mean, it resonates a lot with the kind of terrorism that we've gotten, unfortunately, used to in the last decade or so. And of course, it's interesting that such a modern episode should have taken place in the periphery of Europe. And it's interesting also that, you know, you can go on whatever website about regicide, about anarchism and whatever. That is one of the least covered events. You have much more spectacular events, first of all, because the victim was killed, as in the case of Sisi, of Sadi Carnot, the Russian Tsars and whatever. But there is a Eurocentrism here in the sense that because it happened outside of what is considered to be the borders of quote-unquote civilization, it seems to have fallen through the cracks. And also because Abdulhamid had a terrible reputation, and that if the attempt had succeeded, I don't know what exactly would have happened in terms of reactions against the event, because, I mean, he was considered to be one of the most atrocious autocrats of the time, the Red Sultan, whatever. So he had a very bad reputation. Obviously, he would have benefited from the support, the solidarity of the crowned heads and of any anti-anarchist movement of conservative parties, but he would have been interested. And I think partly the reason why it got so much so little coverage is linked to the fact that it wasn't deemed as important, as crucial, as central as other attempts against crowned heads.
And as you mentioned there, and as various contributors in the book make clear, this was just one of like many attempted assassinations of heads of state and monarchs at the time. And there was this kind of real spate of attacks by mainly various kind of anarchist groups. So Germany's Kaiser Wilhelm I, Belgium's Leopold II, Spain's Alfonso XIII all survived serious assassination attempts. Of course, ones who didn't survive were Tsar Alexander of Russia, France's President Sadi Carnot, King Umberto I of Italy, and of course, very famously, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, among others. So this kind of thing really did mark the era. And what would you say kind of distinguished the attempt on Abdulhamid II from these other contemporary assassination attempts?
Well, what was, I think, different is that it was organized by more than just one single anarchist or an anarchist group. It was nationalist terrorism. I mean, it was Armenian terrorism. And although the main character in the book, for obvious reasons of Belgian and Ottoman diplomacy, was Joris, Edvard Joris, this Belgian anarchist, the event in itself was linked to a long series of Armenian attacks against Ottoman interests ever since the 1890s, in parallel with the rising violence of the Ottoman state against the Armenian population in the 1890s. What is surprising in a sense is that most of the violence took place in the 1890s, 1894, 95, 96, and especially the very visible events of Istanbul, Constantinople in 1895 and 96. This happens 10 years later at a time when, say, the focus of violence is no longer as much on Anatolia as it is on Macedonia, for example. That's really the hotspot of nationalism at the time. So that's one distinguishing feature, I would say, the fact that it is embedded and linked to an ongoing national movement of liberation, as the Armenians saw it, and retaliation against state violence against their people. And what makes it also interesting is, of course, the legal aspect, the legal and political aspect of the question, the way in which Joris, the perpetrator, or at least one of the main perpetrators, was eventually pardoned, and we don't even know how and why. And all the discussions between the Ottoman Empire and the Belgian kingdom concerning the status and the extradition, the possible extradition of Joris. And that is, again, a very distinguishing feature because you're talking about an empire which is in a quasi-colonial position that is ruled with respect to the treatment of foreign nationals, of Western foreign nationals, which is ruled by what is called the capitulations, which is treatises of exception and of extraterritoriality, which grant foreign nationals Gauls, Europeans, a privileged status, almost untouchable in terms of legal, judicial pursuits. So we still don't know. And I think that's one question that needs to be answered, hopefully in the future. What is it exactly that moved Abdulhamid to pardon Yoris at the end of 1 year of imprisonment? I think the context of this unequal diplomacy, this quasi-colonial situation in which the Ottomans are treated with a form of contempt, in a sense, as if they had no right over the jurisdiction, no jurisdiction over the wrongdoings of a foreign national. That is, I think, something that falls right into the discussions of the time concerning the capitulations, one of the major complaints of the Ottoman government with respect to its relations with the West. So I think, you know, there's the nationalist Armenian context. There's this idea of an unequal relationship with respect to legal procedure and jurisdiction that makes it kind of unique. And as I said at the beginning, the fact that it's kind of fallen through the tracks, the cracks of history, that nobody thinks about it anymore.
Which is very strange, because this incident really has today almost completely faded from memory. But at the time, it was a huge diplomatic event, not just in the Ottoman Empire, but across Europe. There were these kind of campaigns centered around Yoris, this arrested Belgian man who was involved in the plot. And this was a very deadly plot. There was, I think, 26 people dead and many more injured.
Yeah.
And it's funny that this character, this Yoris character, became this kind of symbol of an innocent European ensnared in this kind of horrible Ottoman system that was seen as being oppressive. But it's as is described in the book, this really became a kind of flashpoint of kind of symbolic incident in which people could invest all these kind of prejudices about the Ottoman Empire, even though, you know, the person who was arrested was clearly, you know, guilty of some major crime, really.
Definitely, yes. And, you know, I mean, this reminds you a little bit of the context of, say, Midnight Express. I mean, it has an Orientalist twist in the sense that the press has a tendency, the governments not so much. I mean, the governments were, the European governments were torn between two major issues. One was to make sure that the capitulations were respected. And that meant that they should defend foreign national who was tried in the Ottoman Empire. It was a question of principle, because
Be clear, the capitulations were these kind of special legal arrangements for Europeans in the Ottoman Empire that allowed them to basically be tried according to the laws, not of the Ottoman Empire, but of their own states.
Right. It gives them a form of status of exception and extraterritoriality, almost like diplomatic extraterritoriality, if you want, but for every citizen of the European states, of those states that had capitulations with the Ottoman Empire. So these are unequal treaties which have a colonial twist to them. So in that sense, yes, I think the European governments were torn between their hatred of anarchism and the fact that they didn't want to side and to promote an action that was clearly an action of terror and of anarchy. It was a violent action against a legitimate in its own way government and a head of state. So there was some kind of a solidarity at state level with that respect. But on the other hand, they didn't want to cede on the matter of the extraterritoriality and the privileges of their subjects in the Ottoman Empire. So I think there's an interesting dilemma there, which is finally solved by this unilateral pardon, which Abdulhamid grants to Yoris. Thus, it's a very typical Ottoman imperial gesture of magnanimity, which is unilateral. And this is so typical of Abdulhamid in those years. I mean, when you look at the way in which he solves the crisis of the 1896 massacres in Istanbul, where a group of Armenian revolutionaries take the Ottoman Bank in late August of 1890 or September 1896, and they hold it for several days. And this is followed by an outright massacre, a pogrom of the Armenian population in the city. So on the one hand, you have thousands, at least hundreds of Armenians who are slaughtered in the streets of Constantinople within a perimeter which you would assume is under the control of the Sultan. And yet the guys who started the crisis by seizing the Ottoman Bank, they are allowed to leave the country unpunished, and they flee on a French ship to Marseille and then to South America. That's very typical of Abdulhamid in the sense that he will try as much as possible to use his state terror and violence against the locals. But when it comes to foreigners, especially those who have a status of protection that makes them dangerous from a diplomatic perspective, he tries to basically look the other way. And I think although we don't have a concrete explanation for the pardon, I think it falls into that category of crisis management by Abdulhamid in the 1890s and 1900s.
Now, of course, people listening will be probably thinking to themselves that, of course, this whole story carries some quite striking similarities and echoes with some of the situations today as well, because there was this presence of foreign suspects, violence, dark plots, a crackdown in the aftermath, a paranoid ruler, kind of international outrage, all kinds of conspiracy theories swirling around. Was that idea that this was something that kind of resonates today in your mind as you were putting together all these contributions to the book?
Well, yes and no. As a historian, I'm wary of setting up similarities, comparisons with events that happened, say, 100 or 150 years apart. On the other hand, I am more and more convinced that there is something in Abdulhamid's dark modernity which is crucial in the determination of the nature, the form, and the mechanisms and the dynamics of the Turkish state, not just today, but throughout the period that follows the fall of Abdulhamid in 1908. That is much more disturbing in a sense, I mean, than just establishing a similarity between, say, these conspiracy theories. You've always had them, and I think every state has its way of seeing foreign nationals as a potential threat and whatever. Look at what's happening in Iran today, for example. I think it's part of a state rhetoric. And of course, it always comes with the notion that there is no smoke without fire. I mean, there's always, even the most paranoid plots, fantasies, have some kind of a link to some kind of a truth, which makes them extremely dangerous. But then again, my real concern as a historian is to try to understand what it is that Abdulhamid did to the Ottoman state that I think has influenced the way in which the Ottoman state and the Turkish modern state would develop in the decades following his fall. I think there are two major points. One is what I call the dismantlement of the state. That is, if you compare Abdulhamid to the period that comes before him, what is called the Tanzimat, the period of reorganization from the 1840s to the 1870s, where you have a very conservative bureaucracy which tries to establish a modern state based on some kind of a rule of law and some kind of a rational functioning of the cogs, the wheels of the bureaucracy. He dismantles that in order to create his own autocratic regime. That is, basically, he shifts the center of gravity of the state from what used to be its legitimate center, the Grand Vizierate, the Prime Ministry, if you want, to the palace. And instead of relying on the usual structures, the ministries, the councils, and whatever, he kind of empties them and replaces them with informal networks, personalized networks, fragmented networks, which are personally linked to him and which are extremely efficient in carrying on a day-to-day survival of his autocratic regime by combining, spying and threats and political expediency. So he basically empties the state of what you would associate the state with in ideal terms: law, parliamentarism, forms of representation. So that's one aspect of his dark modernity, because it's modern in the sense that he's doing, to a large extent, what the Russian Tsars are doing at the same time. He's setting up a system of autocratic rule by personalizing rule. So that is one thing, the dismantlement of the rule of law and of state mechanisms, the maintenance of what is necessary for his policies of violence, that is the army and the police, the creation of very informal and personalized camarillas and all sorts of, networks. And I think that what he also invents is the sacralization of the state, the idea that the survival of the survival of the state, and by the state he means himself, obviously, you're talking about an autocracy, the survival of the state justifies the overriding of any kind of personal, communal, institutional freedom, right, or autonomy. So this is what I think is very new about the Hamidian regime, and I can see traces of that in the regimes to follow. If you look at the CUP, if you look at the Unionist, the Young Turks, apart from, a very short springtime of Ottoman peoples after 1908, there is a very strong militarization of the state, and basically, again, an abandonment of the rule of law. And again, the survival of the state defined by its owners, quote unquote, becomes the top priority, much higher than any form of recognition of individual rights and autonomies and freedoms. And this, I think, defines also the Kemalist Republic, again, with the argument that the fatherland, the motherland, whatever you want to call it, is at risk, and that therefore that survival justifies a situation of exception. And this is pretty much how Mustafa Kemal and his successor İnönü will rule until World War II. And after that, if there is some kind of a respite, some kind of a loosening of that autocratic regime, it's basically because there is still an institution, the army, and a judicial that takes upon itself the defense of the state as defined by the Kemalist principles, that stand in the way of a full autonomy, a full political autonomy of individuals and even of governments. So I see continuity there, and I think it's pretty much what we see today. So people who accuse the present government of being neo-Kemalist are not far off the track. I think there is some consistency, some continuity there. And the key word there is, again, the fact that the state is hollow, empty, and therefore open to a conquest by any government that is powerful enough and stays in power long enough to control it and therefore to claim it for itself. And then that government speaks in the name of the state and sets the rules of the game by basically saying that, yes, every individual liberty, every individual freedom can be curbed for the general good of the state. And there you have it. The rule of law is suspended or ignored or circumvented and whatever. So that is, I think, what I find to be interesting historically in terms of the impact of Hamid on the decades to follow.
I really want to dig into this question, really, of Abdul Hamid, and particularly the image of him in Turkey today, because, as you'll be well aware, in recent years there's been this explosion, really, of popular interest in him, and specifically among conservatives and religious nationalists, who see him as this kind of last proudly Islamic Ottoman leader standing up to the West. And, of course, they draw this big parallel between him and Erdogan, the current president Erdogan, who's said to be, fulfilling this historical covenant. And and being basically the inheritor of Abdul Hamid's mantle. As a serious historian of this era, how do you reflect on this development that really is just kind of gathering pace? I mean, there's TV series, there's all kinds of magazines, everything, you know, articles every single day, it seems, about how people are reinterpreting or looking back to the Abdul Hamid second era as providing the keys to understand, you know, the present plots and whatnot today.
Right. Well, it's horrible on two counts. I mean, first of all, because it has political implications. And the political implications are basically that you end up espousing, condoning the kind of autocratic regime or authoritarian regime that comes with the recognition of Abdul Hamid as a good sovereign. That's point one. That's a political point. But to the historian, which is really shocking, is that it's based on very, very poor scholarship or on no scholarship at all. That is, it's mythology. I mean, it's, and you know, I mean, again, there's some continuity there. I mean, the way in which Kemalism has created its own narrative, its own image, its own mythology is being repeated here. And I think one of the appeals of Abdul Hamid is that he works very well as an anti-Kemal, as an anti-Ataturk. I think that's really his appeal because, of course, I mean, you can go back to the good old sultans of the 16th century to Mehmed the Conqueror in the 15th century and whatever. But then again, that's history. I mean, you can't really use that as an argument today because the conditions, the context cannot really be copied and pasted onto a present day situation and onto the ideological polarization of Turkey. Whereas Abdul Hamid is practically a contemporary of the Republic. He died in 1918. His memory was very fresh at the beginning of the Republic. And he is the last real sovereign. I mean, when you compare him to his successors, who has played a serious role in defending what he considered to be his domains, his empire and whatever, at the cost of all sorts of horrors and whatever. But in that sense, yes, he is a strong character and a modern one. So if you want to rebuild your Turkish history, not just on the basis of, you know, very far away antecedents, but on the basis of something that still resonates today, Abdul Hamid is the perfect choice in that respect. But of course, I mean, to do so, you have to abandon any kind of scholarly ambition and you have to basically invent history as you go and turn it into something which is a combination of very bad quiche and very, very populist rhetoric with absolutely no rooting in any kind of historical knowledge. So to the historian, that's the rape of history.
That's always, I think, the thing that kind of fascinates me about this kind of reinterpretation. Because for me, like, what as a kind of amateur looking in, what makes Ottoman history so fascinating is the kind of ambiguity and the strangeness, really, of it all. It's full of various different fascinating nooks and crannies and subtleties. And what makes it interesting is the fact that it's basically impossible to fit into any kind of ideological framework. But this kind of reinterpretation of characters like Abdul Hamid II is completely flattening all of that. And it's just extremely, as you say, essentializing and simplistic, and you know what, this really fascinating history is just kind of flattened out to make very simplistic modern political points.
Definitely. And what's really frustrating is that, you know, in the past two decades or so, there's been some very good work done on the Hamidian period. And not everything about the Hamidian period has to be interpreted as being negative. I mean, I have a very good friend and colleague, Selim Derengil, who's done a brilliant book on Abdul Hamid and his modernity. That's very good scholarship. And it doesn't say, while it recognizes that Abdul Hamid is modernizing the empire and using modernity as a tool of holding together the pieces of the empire, he's not condoning his political aims. And even these political aims, the real problem is that any political regime can be studied in its own context. It becomes a problem when you start to transpose, to transplant the ideologies or whatever of 100 years earlier into the present situation. situation and try to draw parallels. I mean, that's exactly what you shouldn't do in history. And that's what they're doing, because what they're doing is not history. So that is very frustrating. And again, as a historian, as a professional of a certain discipline, I feel that this is an infringement on my turf, on my rights, my autonomy, my competences. And it's terrible. It's reducing history. I mean, history was always very problematic in Turkey, but it's become intolerable.
I suppose you can't bring yourself to watch the TV series Pai Tat, which I think is just second series.
I haven't. I've watched like 20 minutes and it's infuriating. First of all, because it's bad. I mean, you know, it's a bad series. I mean, that's one of the major problems. I mean, you could have an ideologically very biased, but at least cinematographically a decent thing. It's not. It's like, you know, it's like a first grade a theater. It's terrible. Second, I still don't know what they mean by Pai Tat Abdulhamid. I mean, this is something that it mesmerizes me because it has no meaning. Pai Tat in Turkish, in Ottoman Turkish, means literally the foot of the throne, which means the capital of the state. And Abdulhamid is the guy's name. So when you call him the foot of the throne, that's nonsensical. I really don't know. If somebody can come up with an answer as to what exactly they mean by that, because Pai Tat is Istanbul, you can say Abdulhamid's Pai Tat or whatever, but Pai Tat Abdulhamid means nothing, or it means basically that he's the throne, and I really don't know what that might mean. So, and finally, it's terrible because it is really built on the desire to basically camouflage very, very amateurishly, camouflage the questions of today into some kind of a Istanbul Belle Epoque, end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century context. And, you know, it's appalling. It's appalling. So, yeah, 20 minutes. I mean, I haven't watched it all. I will never watch it all. I mean, I don't think it's watchable. But I think 20 minutes is enough to give you a sense and of how terrible it is.
I heard, finishing this book, actually, Erdogan gave a speech last week in which he mentioned explicitly that people should watch Pai Tat to understand history. I mean, it was a really kind of mind-boggling moment. I mean, you know, you shouldn't really be surprised by any of this stuff, but it's the idea that he explicitly recommended it as being a kind of guide for understanding the present day.
I know.
Through this very distorted lens of looking at Abdulhamid II's reign.
It is frightening, but it's not as inconsistent with the past as one might think. I mean, this is pretty much, I mean, we live in an age where the image, where the visual, where the social media is so powerful that we think the content and the way in which it is manipulated is completely novel. In fact, it's not. I mean, pretty much this is what the Kemalist regime tried to do with its own narratives, its own mythology, but through means that were much more primitive because that technology did not exist. I've lived in Turkey in the late 70s and 80s. I've seen, I've watched TV and the way in which the Kemalist saga was being depicted and whatever, it's not really different. What is different is, of course, the massiveness of the impact today because of this this new technology, this new visibility, which makes it, you know, so that is, it's crucial, I think, to understand that what we consider to be a new phenomenon is perhaps an epiphenomenon, a marginal phenomenon, some kind of a twist in much more continuity than one would be ready to admit.
Yes, and the other thing, I suppose, just to conclude, really, is this idea, this kind of new popular resurgence in interest in Abdulhamid II, it's actually not entirely new, because, of course, people like this, you know, the hardline Islamic poet Necip Fazıl Kısakırık, he long lionized Abdulhamid II for basically all the reasons why people do the same today. So there really are these kind of very deep conservative roots there that have long seen Abdulhamid II as this great symbol.
Yes. And he published his book in 1965. The only difference is that in those quote unquote good old days, you had the army and the judicial that basically defended the interests of the Kemalist state and therefore did not allow for the propagation of that kind of material beyond very limited marginal circles. So there you have it again. I mean, it was limited at the price of, well, a form of authoritarian regime under military and judicial tutelage. So even there, you can find some continuity. But it's true. Ever since the 1950s, popular culture has been strongly influenced by an Islamist tendency, which finds its best expression in Ottomanism, in anything Ottoman, because Ottoman means to them, and that's where they're wrong again, means Turkish plus Islamic. And therefore, that has been exploited ever since the 1950s. 1953, the fifth centennial of the conquest of Constantinople, is a turning point in the recreation of this narrative at the time of the Menderes government, which was much more sympathetic, say, to such conservative moves. So there's no real difference in that sense, except that now the state has been reconquered by those who used to work in the shadows because they were under the threat, under the thumb of another authoritarian state, the one that followed the Kemalist path. I don't know, maybe I'm a little too dark in my pessimism, but I think I see a lot of continuity there. And in a sense, I think that if we do not address this continuity, if we treat the problem of today only as a problem of today, we're missing what is an essential part of Turkish political culture. The fact that democracy and the major points that you would associate with a democratic rule are not strongly embedded in Turkey. And I'm not talking only of people in power. I'm talking about the population at large.
That was Edhem Eldem. Many thanks to him. Check out armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com for a link to my review in Hurriyet Daily News of the volume that we were talking about. A very stimulating book it is too. I've also posted on there a link to an article that I wrote last year for the History Today magazine, looking at this growing cult of Abdul Hamid II in today's Turkey. Well worth a read, I dare say, if you find all this stuff interesting. Remember, you can support this podcast via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, Paul Levin, Tan Tunala, Ayla Jean Yakli, and Burak Kodaz. Remember, in a couple of weeks, I'll be getting back to you about Turkey Book Talk's new membership system, which is all very exciting. Don't forget to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can also follow via Twitter or like that Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. I also very much enjoy receiving emails from listeners, so please do send any recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, once again, thank you very much for listening.